Well, after today we're done with Rajneesh Puram, today we're going to talk about some of the law enforcement people's worst nightmare scenarios, because unlikely as it sounds to those of us who actually lived through this process, a lot of law enforcement people who worked this case think it could have easily ended in what they referred to as a bloody mess. I mean, a Jonestown, Guyana kind of bloody mess. And they may be right. I'm Finn J.D. John. It's Wednesday, April 25th. And you're listening to me read you an archive from the columns of the weekly newspaper column I write, Offbeat Oregon History. I do this every day, and of course, if you're subscribed to the podcast, you already know that. And if you'd like to know more about the podcast or the newspaper column, stay tuned or check out offbeatoregon.com. So today's article ran in the newspapers under the headline, Rajneesh Puram, Did It Almost Turn Into an Oregon Jonestown? On May 30th, 2010. Here we go. The story of a small and secretive cult group of people deciding to go out in a blaze of glory rather than submitting to outside authority is a familiar one these days, harking back to the infamous story of Jonestown, Guyana in 1978. Familiar but outrageous enough that most people think it can't happen here. Yet if you ask certain law enforcement people who were on duty in the mid-1980s, they'll disagree with you on that. Some of them might even tell you that in their opinion, it almost did. So here's what happened. In late 1985, after the public split between Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh and his erstwhile spokeswoman, Mahanan Sheila Silverman, the Bhagwan invited police to enter Rajneesh Puram and gather evidence against her. What they found was chilling enough, but in the context of the Rajneesh group's earlier predictions of catastrophe and Armageddon, it became actually truly frightening. They found two laboratories set up to produce biological and chemical agents that could certainly be used as weapons. They also found some books detailing how that might be done. Deadly Substances, Handbook for Poisoning, The Perfect Crime and How to Commit It, Let Me Die Before I Awake. These were some of the titles of books that they found there. Well, a few days later, the Bhagwan started getting less cooperative. Newspaper and TV people poured in from all over the world. Law enforcement people started to complain that they weren't being allowed to do the job the Bhagwan had invited them to do. Then came the spark that could have blown the whole thing up. A court in Portland issued a sealed indictment against the Bhagwan on immigration violation charges. This presented law enforcement officers with a serious problem. It was now their duty to go and get him. But for some time, the Rajneesh quote, peace patrol had been furnished with particularly warlike equipment, including Colt AR-15 rifles that were the civilian equivalent of the U.S. Army's main weapon. Officers had been there long enough, working on the Sheila investigation, to know the place was well-armed and arranged for defense. A few weeks before, the Bhagwan had announced to his followers that they no longer had to wear the distinctive red robes that would, in a worst-case scenario, mark them as members. Police in the compound, both investigators invited in by the Bhagwan and undercover agents posing as followers, warned darkly that any attempt to serve a warrant on the Bhagwan at the compound would probably turn into a bloody mess. Luckily, the Bhagwan solved the problem for them by chartering a Learjet and trying to flee to Bermuda. Thus, instead of having to invade a heavily armed compound with an enormous SWAT team, authorities simply had to dispatch two U.S. Marshals to intercept him in North Carolina during a stop for fuel and pick him up. Authorities later learned, according to Dick Pintark's account, that the Peace Patrol did in fact have a contingency plan for how to respond to an attempt to arrest the Bhagwan. It involved encircling the leader with a human shield of women and children while security forces shot to kill. If all the participants cooperated, it would be hard to imagine something like this ending well for anyone. The Bhagwan's arrest was the end of Oregon's Rajneesh experience. Well, sort of. Sheila, arrested in Germany and extradited, pleaded guilty to several poisoning and arson attempts and was sentenced to 20 years in prison and ordered to leave the country immediately after serving her time. The Bhagwan was simply deported, with the prison sentence suspended on condition that he leave immediately. Sheila, after being represented by powerful and expensive legal teams both in Germany and the U.S., suddenly became unable to afford to pay $270,000 of her fine. There had been $57 million in cash and hard portable assets, mostly jewelry, on the Bhagwan's books. Now there was no sign of it, and to this day authorities have no idea what happened to it. Maybe it was quietly embezzled by one of the sannyasins. Perhaps the Bhagwan managed to somehow smuggle it out of the country for later use in building his luxurious meditation resort in India. Or maybe it's simply buried somewhere out in the high country of north central Oregon waiting for someone to come back and dig it up. We'll probably never know. There's an afterword, and a rather sinister one. Sheila was released from federal prison after serving 29 months of her sentence. She immediately married a sannyasin from Switzerland, Urs Birnstiel, and left for Switzerland with him, leaving Oregon authorities in the lurch for more than $60,000 in court-ordered fees and restitution. She was arrested in late 1985, so this would have happened around 1988 or 89. But in 1992, Birnstiel died of AIDS, which Sheila told Willamette Week magazine he contracted after their separation. Thus, Birnstiel apparently, in the course of 3, maybe 4 years, got married, got separated, contracted the HIV virus, developed full-blown AIDS, and died. A timetable without parallel, so far as I know, in the history of human experience with this disease when it is naturally acquired. I have been unable to find any explanation of, or even reference to, the fact that a disease that usually takes a decade to even manifest itself killed Birnstiel in less than 3 years. If you have any information that might help clear this mystery up, I hope that you'll contact me. You've been listening to an Offbeat Oregon History Archive column. If you'd like more, you can read hundreds of columns from the last 4 years on the website. It's at offbeatoregon.com. On the website, you can also subscribe to get these podcasts delivered directly to your smartphone every day via RSS or iTunes, or join the conversation on the Facebook page or Twitter feed. All Offbeat Oregon stuff is covered under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. See offbeatoregon.com/cc for details. Finally, if you're ever up in Corvallis and have time for a cup of something, please look me up. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon. Have a great day.